Cuba, at one. And meanwhile, a suspension of the quarantine measures involving the searching of ships bound for Cuba. And this for 2 to 3 weeks to allow some quiet negotiations to resolve the crisis. And he also added that I make myself available to all the parties for whatever services I may be able to perform. He also sent an appeal to Castro in order not to leave him out of the picture after all these bases were in his territory, asking for even restraint and appealing to him to resort to negotiations. The following day, he received a... There's an interesting anecdote here. Mr. Zorin obviously did not like this appeal at all. He thought that Assange should condemn, you know, the U.S. measures against Cuba. But he was very miffed to see that there were some 50 ambassadors lining up to congratulate Assange on his speech at the end of the council meeting. But he wanted to see him, but he did not. Assange said, I'm very tired, I want to get up very late at night.
Yeah.
And perhaps you could come tomorrow. So when he saw him the following day, he protested on his day. And Assange asked him, are you protesting in your personal capacity or on instructions from your government? He always had this blunt language in the direct language, very unlike his Buddhist, you know, quiet demeanor, his polite way of dealing. So sometimes he did. And Zorin was taken aback, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in the day, he received an urgent call from Ambassador Morozov, the deputy of Zorin, saying him, I must see him urgently because he has a message for him. And the message was from Khrushchev, saying, dear Assange, I accept your proposals and I'm willing to discuss them with you and with the U.S. So Zorin had made really a faux pas.
Mm-hmm.
He was speaking either without instructions or he was completely in the dark. Maybe he was not aware of what was happening in Cuba, and that was the assumption.
I see. So, when you say that Assange made an appeal, was this in the form of a speech to the Security Council?
No, a speech in the Security Council plus direct messages to Moscow and Washington.
Okay, and the messages were sent, how? Were they sent by?
They were sent by cable.
By cable.
By open cable.
Open cable.
Because he has read them. I mean, that was these messages were open. They were not sent by code. Open and with copies to the U.S. mission to the Cuba.
Okay. But the one to Moscow was sent directly to Khrushchev, and the one to the United States was directly
to President Kennedy.
And they were in by cable. Are there copies of the cables in the records?
Yes.
Okay, in the archives?
In the archives of the Security Council records.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, so for people doing further research.
Yes, Of course.
And then he also made a speech to the Security Council itself.
He read these two identical messages in the course of his intervention in the Security Council.
In the Security Council.
So the Security Council was his speech, his personal appeal, plus the identical messages that he had sent to Khrushchev and to Kennedy.
Okay.
And the following day, both leaders responded favorably,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, were because of this incident with Trump and Zoe, Khrushchev decided to send one of his very top aides by the name of Kuznetsov, yes.
Kuznetsov,
who was the first deputy foreign minister. And President Kennedy appointed John McCloy. John McCloy was a personal friend, and he was president of some, I don't recall exactly, some bank. He's a banker,
okay.
as head of the U.S. delegation. In fact, he was senior to Adlai Stevenson. I suppose being the big name and being a close friend of the president,
mm-hmm.
for the negotiations that took place on the 38th floor, you know, of how to resolve this. And there was about three or four different messages. There is no room or time now to all these were exchanged. But immediately there was the knowledge that the Soviets are willing to dismantle the missile bases, and to carry back the missiles to the Soviet Union. At that point, when this agreement, this Lindsay agreement, was reached, Castro sent a very angry message to the farm, announcing, you know, the U.S. He brought in the U.S. troops on the island in the base of it's a part of Cuba.
Oh, Guantanamo.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right.
He brought this in, and he brought that all this. The majors are a threat to the independence of Cuba and to the peace and security of Cuba. And they invited Osant to go. Osant immediately decided to go because he felt that what is happening now between the U.S. through his mediation, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, is keeping Castro out of the picture,
uh-huh.
and he is in a position to do something that might reflect on the understanding of sabotage the agreement.
Yeah.
So he decided to go. He did go. We went about 20 hours to go.
Okay, so you went with Usant when he went to Cuba.
I was with him.
When was that? Do you recall what the date was?
He went. He left New York on the 30th of October to Havana on the charter Brazilian aircraft, and we arrived the same day in the afternoon, and the talks with the hope that Castro would accept some kind of UN supervision over the removal of the missiles. That was the hope, but the intention really of the basic thing was to keep Castro quiet, to give him the deference and the respect that he would not do anything to upset the agreements already reached between the Americans and the Soviets with the Sixth Army in New York. That was the real purpose,
mm-hmm.
of the trip. So when he arrived on the same direct plane that he was traveling for this trip, some eager beaver UN officials thought that they would, the mission, the UN mission to Cuba for observing the missiles initially was fait accompli, so they put all sorts of communication gear, boxes of photocopy machines, all the paraphernalia that is needed to set up the mission. Osant was unaware of this completely. Nobody bothered him to clear it with him. So when we arrived in Havana, he was in the first car, and Raul Roa, Prime Minister of Castro, of Cuba, was there to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Raul Roa. Okay.
Raul, R-A-U-L, and Roa, R-A-U-A, Roa.
Okay.
The Foreign Minister of Cuba.
Okay. Thank you.
The soldiers, I mean, the meeting was very, I mean, the reception was very friendly, but the soldiers immediately surrounded the plane and they unloaded its boxes. And before the France car departed, there was a colonel or a major, an officer, came and whispered something into Raul Roa's ear. And nothing was said, but in the car, Raul Roa simply asked, he said, Mr. Secretary General, what are all these boxes you brought in with you?
Right.
He said, what boxes?
Yeah.
And he was traveling with the hand luggage.
Yeah.
Others, all of us.
Yes.
He said, I've got 10 boxes, you know, all big wooden boxes. He said, I don't know, but I certainly will find out. So as soon as we settled in the villa, the guest house, he called in Don Thomas, his personal aide, the security man, and said, Don, what are these boxes? Don said, I don't know, sir. What boxes? Maybe General Ricky, the military advisor, might know. So he called in Ricky. Ricky said, no, I don't know. But
General Ricky had come with you?
Yes, General Ricky was in the party. No, if you want the names of the people who were.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Okay.
There was Omar Lotfi. Omar Lotfi was his closest political advisor on this.
Omar
Lotfi. Lotfi.
Okay.
Omar Lotfi, an Egyptian,
uh-huh.
Former Egyptian ambassador who joined earlier that year, switched from the ambassador to Omar Lotfi. And then was
But you mentioned General Ricky
from India, who was the military advisor to the Secretary General.
Mm-hmm.
General Indir Ricky was at the party, and then you want to stop this for
a
second?
Sure. All right, so we're just naming now the people who had gone on the mission to Cuba.
To Havana. Yes.
So Omar.
Omar,
Lotfi.
Lotfi.
Yeah.
His political advisor. Hernan Tavares de Sá,
mm-hmm.
Brazilian head of the Office of Public Information. Brigadier Inder J. Ricky, military advisor, Miguel Marin, interpreter, and myself.
Okay.
And
then you had Donald Thomas,
personal aide and chief of security and the secretary.
Okay.
That was a
good.
The whole lot.
So someone back in New York had thought that the UN was going to set up an office there.
An office there.
And had put in all the office equipment.
Without, you know, which was a stupid thing, frankly, to do, because first of all, they should have cleared it with the Secretary General. After all, he's the one who's doing, and Secretary General would have cleared it in turn with the Cubans. We were going there to talk to them, not to set a mission with or without their consent.
That's right.
So this was one of those things, but happily, it did not mar his negotiations with Castro, because they really believed him, and he was telling the truth that he had no knowledge of this. Because in the moment he heard about it, he said, you know, just he gave words and please put it back on the plane, they are going back with me.
Yeah.
And there was another plane waiting with more equipment and more people in New York. You see this eager beaver, you know, sometimes, God help me from my friends, I can take care of my enemies.
Right.
So I think that we should take this out.
So they kept that plane from actually taking off?
Yes. He asked Ricky to speak to Narasimha and to speak to him in Hindi and Urdu to tell him, to give him the order of 60 general, keep that plane, don't have it fly to Havana, because we were sure that our lives were...
Being listened to or tapped, yeah. And Narasimha was, what was his position?
He was the chef de cabinet.
Narasimha was the chef de cabinet for Utan back in New York.
Back in New York. So Ricky from Havana, on the instructions of Utan, called Narasimha to say, keep that plane in New York, and, you know, disassemble the party, whatever.
I had never heard of that incident. Very interesting. That's great.
I have it. I would have been delighted to give you a copy of this, but it's the last one I have. But if you want, it is available in the bookshop and in the library. If you want to look it up.
Yes. Yeah. I'll do that. Okay.
I would have liked to give you a copy as a gift, but I don't have another copy.
Yeah.
So in the talks with Castro, it was his delegation, you know, the three people, Ricky, Lutfi, and Tavares Bessant, and he didn't get anywhere with Castro. Castro wanted no supervision of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. He was very bitter against the agreement reached without his knowledge, without his blessing. But appealed for the sake of peace, for the sake of the safety of his country, because at the time, you know, there were a lot of generals in the United States saying, let's go and bomb the hell out of them and invade Cuba. It's as simple as that. Which, luckily, President Kennedy did not listen to them. So Lutfi suggested that perhaps, since we're not getting anywhere after 3 hours of talks, if you suggest to Castro to meet with him alone, tête-à-tête, the following day, without him, with this big delegation, Castro immediately accepted that. It was a little note that was passed on, of course, to him. He accepted that. And the following day, they reached some kind of agreement that he would not. He had intended to attack Hoche, Castro, in a speech saying that, you know, he sold us down the river to reach an agreement with the Americans and the rest of it. And so Santa Peter was to be moderate and not to say anything, to upset what is really happening in New York. He said he would do his best, he didn't promise, he said he would do his best. And towards the end of the meeting, before we departed and went back to New York, he asked Castro on a humanitarian basis if he would send the body of Major Anderson. Major Anderson was a pilot of a U-2, that was shot down over Havana. I suppose he was very eager to take pictures of the missiles and all that. Casualty, he said, yes, yes, I accept this, and I will do it. So when he came back, the son came back, oh yes, there's something important happened. That night, that same night, the talks with Castro in the morning and the afternoon were stalled. That evening, after dinner, the Soviet ambassador, accompanied by a Soviet general, came to see the son at his residence.
And this was the ambassador to Cuba
from
the Soviet Union.
Of the Soviet Union,
yeah.
To Cuba, accompanied by this general. And they wanted to see the son, and they wanted to see the moon, which they did. And they saw him simply to say that on instructions from Moscow, we have started disassembling all the bases and the missiles will be shipped. That was the 31st of October.
Mm-hmm.
And the missiles will be shipped back on the 2nd of November, 3 days back.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really elated with this news, and he was from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Right, yeah.
Not from Castro, but from the people who were there doing this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but at the, when he met with Castro alone, Ufant knew full well that Castro was informed about the visit, but he was not informed about what transpired in the meeting, because there was nobody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he was saying, Castro and Castro didn't bring it up either. But when we arrived in New York, he made a very brief statement at the airport. There were 300 correspondents. It was either right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The
so Ufant, when he came in, made a brief presentation?
A statement at the airport.
At the airport.
Simply saying that, you know, during my stay, I have some very good talks with President Castro, and while I was there, I was reliably informed that the missiles will be carried out on the 2nd of October, and at my request, the body of Major Anderson will be taken back to the United States. And this really was the one thing that inflated the whole war hysteria in the U.S. was about, you know, send our troops and our air force. And this was the beginning of the quieting down of the crisis.
I see. Okay. So from you were in the meeting with Castro in Havana.
No, I was not in the meeting with Castro. I was briefed by Ufant.
Okay.
Nor was I at the meeting with the ambassador, and because there were only the three.
Uh-huh.
It was Ufant, the ambassador, the Soviet ambassador, and the Soviet general. But it was Ufant who told me what inspired. And then, of course, it was in the press release that we prepared together.
Which he read
at the airport on arrival from Havana.
But then, your impression when you were in Cuba that Castro did not want the missiles removed?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely, he did not. He did not, and he wanted to bargain with the U.S. about that. But the U.S., before the Soviet Union, decided to remove the missiles and to disassemble the bases, had received from the U.S. a pledge from Kennedy that he was going to lift the blockade and he will not invade Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, a tic-tac, if you like. This was our commitment for peace, and provided that you remove your missiles. But it came after this, Khrushchev had promised to take the missiles out. There was some other secret deal with between the US and the USSR regarding Turkey, but it was not part of the UN.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't part of the UN law.
No, but it was a sort of bilateral thing between Turkey, between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Okay.
But the UN was not involved in that. The UN was not involved.
Okay. So Castro was angry the missiles being removed.
Yes,
and he was
agreement.
Going to give a speech in Havana
attacking
Khrushchev.
Uh-huh. Khrushchev. But in that he made that speech, and actually his reference to Khrushchev was very mild. So he more or less kept his word to Othon.
Yes.
Because he said he would think about it and he would see how much he could go.
Mm-hmm.
It was very mild. And then after that, there was this attempt to appease him in Moscow. They sent one of their top men. If you're interested in that, on a very hard trip to see Othon, and from Othon they went to Havana just to try and keep him quiet. After the missile crisis was over.
Okay, so could you explain that?
Yes. I mean, if you're interested.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but I don't want to, you know, talk your ears off. And
should I just turn this off for a minute?
Sure.
Yes.
To help soothe Castro, Moscow dispatched Anastas Mikoyan, Soviet deputy prime minister, to Havana. En route, he made a one-day stopover in New York, held the meeting with the front on November 1, and gave a press conference to deny to the world that there was any rift between the Soviet Union and Cuba.
I see, okay.
Mikoyan was a clever performer. He knew how to field advising questions from reporters and succeeded in giving the impression that the crisis was over.
Okay, so he had a private meeting with Othon.
With Othon, and then proceeded to And on January 7, 1963, Othon received an unprecedented joint letter signed by Stevenson and Kuznetsov. It read, on behalf of the government of the United States of America and the Soviet Union, we desire to express to you our appreciation for your efforts in assisting our governments to avert the serious threat to peace which recently arose in the Caribbean area.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that perhaps to case for professors or researchers or scholars that exists.
Yes, okay, so that's also
the Security Council document.
That, okay. Well, that was a very important period of time and a very important intervention on the part of
Iran. Yeah, and we were very close to, but in the years that were to follow that, he, Othon, went out of his way to give great credit to the wisdom and statesmanship of the two leaders, Kennedy and Khrushchev.
Yeah.
Obviously, neither of them was a sort of a war monger or a saddle rattler.
Mm-hmm.
And their restraint and their wisdom said, what's it, the world really be like?
Right, right, because it could have been.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here talking about it. You know?
Right, exactly. Well, again, there were many crises that were going on during the time that Othon was Secretary General. Now I'd like to move to the Middle East and talk about what was going on in the Middle East at the time. There were the UN emergency force
was there
on Egyptian soil.
Egyptian soil, because the Israelis would not have it on their
Israelis refused to have the peacekeepers on Israeli territory.
They were there, the UNIF, as a result of an agreement reached between Dag Hammarskjöld and President Nasser personally. After, I think, a marathon talks that lasted some 7 or 8 hours outside Cairo, But as you know, the UNIF was established by the under the General Assembly resolution.
That's right. It was a General Assembly resolution.
Yeah,
now, where were you at during that period of time? Because you weren't the spokesman for Uthan, because he wasn't Secretary General
no,
then.
No,
what were you doing then?
I was in the UN Secretariat. I was in the press section.
You were in the press section of the Secretariat. Okay. So you were aware of what was going on in the General Assembly.
Yes.
At the time of the creation of of the first UNEF.
The idea, even if it was an idea of Lester Peace, the Prime Minister of Canada.
Yes, right.
He was the one who came up with that idea.
Yeah.
And he discussed it with Foster Thanos, Secretary of State,
right.
Who liked it, because the Security Council, as you know, was blocked completely because of the stretch that the British used their veto on a U.S. resolution. That's after the invasion of the Suez Canal area.
Yeah.
In 1956.
Right. And then the issue was switched to the General Assembly.
Under the United for Peace.
Do you recall exactly how the mechanism took place where they switched it? Was it a vote in the Security Council, or was it a vote in the General Assembly?
No, it was a vote in the General Assembly to have an emergency session of the General Assembly, because the Security Council was stalemated because of the two vetoes of the French and the British.
So by calling on the Uniting for Peace, I understand that there are several ways that you can actually do that. Mm-hmm. You can actually have a vote in the Security Council to switch it. But in this particular case, the General Assembly appealed to...
No, the General Assembly was called at the request of the United States, in fact.
The United States calls an emergency session of the General Assembly.
The United States was 100% against that action.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Cabot Lodge was the representative then, in 1956. Very strong attack on Britain, France, and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And President Eisenhower went as far as cut off the financial aid to Israel as a result. But that's not, you know, the UN
right,
part.
Right.
And then the UN force was created by that resolution. It was the idea of the secretary, thanks really to the energy of the late Dag Hammarskjöld, assisted by Ralph Bunche Bryan and his staff, that they managed to put it together and dispatch it. And that was the price to have the forces withdraw from the three invading forces in the British branch, and the Israelis in Egyptian territory.
So you were a member of the press corps?
Yeah. No, not the press corps. I was with the United Nations, in the press section of the United Nations.
Okay, in the United Nations,
in the
press section of the United Nations. Okay, so that you wrote press releases for the UN.
I was also
So you weren't writing for, say, an Egyptian newspaper?
No, I was. Before that, I was, but not in 56. I was already, because I joined the UN in 53.
Okay.
As I said in the little introduction.
Okay.
So
okay. At any rate, the UN force had been there since 1956.
Yes.
But by 1967, President Nasser had asked to have the UNF.
I'll give you the exact name. The first word of Nasser to say was May 16, 1967.
Okay, May 16, 1967.
And it was in the message from the Egyptian chief of staff, General Fawzi, to General Ricci. General Ricci at the time was the commander of UNIF.
Right.
Commander, we mentioned General Ricci before. That was in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
He was military advisor to the front.
Mm-hmm.
In 1967, he was the commander of UNIF, with headquarters in Gaza.
In Gaza.
And that message for the withdrawal of Yusuf, which was wrong in procedure, came from the Egyptian general, the chief of staff of the Egyptian army, to...
Okay, and that was Fawzi.
It was this Fawzi, his name was Fawzi.
Yeah, general, so General Fawzi sent a message to General Rickey.
Saying that he...
Was
he,
asking the...
Not there was... It was a very... How should I put it? It was rather ambiguous. He said, for security reasons... I have the text of the message if you're interested. If it's of interest to you, I can read it to you. Verbatim, if you like, but it was ambiguous to remove them for security reasons, and we are maneuvering and do it urgently. So what Ricky did, the right thing, he just sent that message to Uthant.
Okay, so General Rickey then forwarded that message to Uthant.
Yes.
But General Fawzi had not sent the message to Uthant. He had sent it to General Rickey.
To General Rickey, uh-huh. Yes. That this request should have been a proper request from the government of Egypt, mm-hmm, to the Secretary General of the United Nations,
yeah,
which was not the case.
Yeah.
But that came later,
okay,
a couple of days later.
Okay,
they
so
sent the official request for the removal of.
Okay, so the General Rickey sent it on to Uthant. So, so what was Uthant's initial response to having seen?
His response was absolutely was shock.
Yeah.
Was shock because he was sure that this would mean, if carried out, it would mean war.
Yeah.
And he said so. He warned the Egyptians of the consequences. He went and saw the ambassadors of the countries providing the forces of UNAMA.
He met with the contributing countries
yes,
in New York.
In New York.
Yeah, okay.
And of course they were all of the opinion that the Egyptians don't want us there. We have no intention of staying against the wish of the Egyptian people, of the Egyptian government, rather, because we are there with the consent of the government, which was a fact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There, perhaps, he should, I felt very strongly that he should take the whole thing to the Security Council. That before he gave the order, he should go to the Security Council and say, here is the situation, what should I do? But Bunch and Brian Elker thought differently, and simply because this force was put there by the General Assembly, not by the Security Council, on the legality of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a junior officer. Bunch was the sort of very high political advisor. Uthant valued his advice a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So his opinion prevailed. And on this matter, and Uthant really took the brunt of the whole blame. Of the whole blame. And Brian Urquhart, later on, in his introduction, wrote this, which I think for historic reasons should be. These are not my words, but Brian Urquhart's words. Uthant proved a useful scapegoat for the Middle East War in 1967, but it's less often recalled that he was the only world statesman who went to Cairo before the war to reason with President Nasser.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about that trip. He went to Cairo.
Oh yes, he went to Cairo.
Okay, and when did he go? Did he go shortly after having received the message from the government?
No, I'll tell you exactly. The message,
okay.
May 16 was the first
the message to General Ricci.
General Ricci. Then, May 18, Othan asked Ambassador Gideon Raphael of Israel if UNIF were to be withdrawn from Egypt, would Israel accept it to station it on the Israeli side?
Okay.
Raphael rejected the idea out of hand. On May 19, Othan reported to the Security Council about the gravity of the situation. On 22nd of May, we left for Cairo, Air France to Paris. In Paris, the following morning, the 23rd, Othan was informed at the airport that Nasser closed the Strait of Tiran. You know, that's the Sharm el-Sheikh.
Right.
At this point, he really was not only surprised. He was very good at not showing his emotions, and he had this Buddhist tradition of keeping, you know, his anger, his shock. He never really showed. But he asked us, his party plus a few people who were at the airport to receive him, one from the French Foreign Office, the KSA, and Gibson Parker, who was the head of the UN office in Paris, who informed him of this, to leave him alone, because he had to decide whether he wants to proceed to Cairo or go back.
Yeah.
And of course, I simply, when he looked at me, he was like, should I say something? So I only said that, sir, if you were to go back, it's like you're inviting the parties to go to war. That's all I said.
He said,
well, I just want you to leave me alone. He retired for about 5 minutes, and he came back and said that he decided to proceed to go to Cairo.
He went
to Cairo. He was very well received there. But he came up with an idea of a sort of, I want to be very specific on this because this is really history now. It's oral history, not personal. It's not blogging. Would you like to perhaps to stop this for
okay,
a second?
Sure. Then you left Paris and went to Cairo.
We went to Cairo.
Yes.
And we arrived in Cairo. We were received very warmly and very nicely by the Egyptian government. He put us up at the Hilton Hotel. And in his talk, he talked first with the foreign minister. His name was Mahmoud Riyad. And his first thing he asked him, he said he could not understand why this decision was taken and was announced while I was on my way to Cairo, which was, I think, a very legitimate question on the part of the foreign. The foreign minister dodged the issue. He said, the president will explain all that to you at dinner this evening. He didn't want to, I guess he was embarrassed and he didn't know what to say. To put it bluntly.
Right.
So he put to him this proposal that Egypt should not take any action in the Gulf. And he would appeal to Israel not to send ships during that period so as to allow time for discussion. The foreign minister, Mahmoud Riyad, was not committed. Then in the evening, Othman attended the dinner given by President Nasser at his residence. And he repeated this proposal. And Nasser accepted it, provided Israel accepts it.
Now, the proposal was for...
A quiet period, I mean, that Egypt should not take any action in the Strait of Tiran. Meanwhile, Israel would not try to send any vessels, any ships, to test the ban and to allow time for negotiations. Nasser said yes, he would accept that, provided Israel accepts it. And then he asked the pertinent question. Othman again expressed his surprise that the decision to close the Gulf was taken while he was on his way to Cairo and stressed the seriousness of that action. Nasser explained that the decision had been taken a long time before, but he had to announce it before Ufang's arrival so that it would not appear as a snub.
I see. So Nasser had already made the decision long ago. He didn't want it to be linked in some way to Uthman's visit.
But anyway, it was considered a snub anyway, and they could have waited, you know, until he has been there and see what he has to say, and then take the decision later, before the decision. Mm-hmm. But this is exactly what happened.
Yeah, okay.
He asked Nasser for his reaction for the moratorium in the Gulf and the appointment of a special representative of the Secretary General. He would accept for 2 weeks, provided Israel also complied. And then Nasser expressed his gratitude to UNMIF for keeping the peace in the area and offered the highest military decoration and recognition for its efforts.
But Uthant was not able to convince Nasser to withdraw his request to have the UN removed.
I had appealed to Uthant privately when we were together to send an appeal, a personal appeal to Nasser, as he did in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes,
I lost my voice, excuse me. But he mentioned this idea of death.